You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting no more Peggy O's.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks again for tuning in to the Riff Raff. What, I don't even know which number this is. God, it's 20-something now. Anyway, I'm sorry I haven't done an episode in a while. I've actually been busy in the studio working with a few different artists, so try to do these as time permits. It's getting harder and harder, but thank you always for your comments and your kind ratings and all the love, all the emails I get constantly. My guest today is my man Oz Noy. For those of you that don't know, Oz is just a ridiculously great guitar player. He's from Israel. He's been in New York City for 20 years. He's built up a big, nice resume of, sideman credits and studio things, but it's his solos material that is particularly gratifying to listen to me and most people. That's what I know him as. And here's a guy who's playing with the creme de la creme of musicians in the world, rhythm sections, he being a part of that for sure, and touring all over the world doing his own things. Very, very cool. Not easy to do. He's got some instructional videos and 9 solo records. We actually tried to do this interview a few weeks before the one that you're going to hear. We did it, actually. Just, I don't know, I wasn't happy with the way it came out. Audio was messed up on it. So got together again, the much improved version that you'll soon hear. This was a particularly stressful day for me because I was doing a 3-night thing at the Iridium. And I ran up to Oz's apartment on the Upper West Side and knocked it out really quick. So I think it came out pretty good, though. Oz plays great. We'll trade off. By the way, I'm on the right side, and Oz is on the left side, guitar-wise. And we'll talk about all kinds of stuff. New York City, his career, early years, influences, state of the blues, gear, pedals, all that kind of stuff. And I hope you'll enjoy it. Walking into Oz's, he's got all kinds of great amps and guitars, and I plug into one of his, a Fender Deluxe or a Princeton or something.
Whatever you want to plug.
Sounds great. Oz plugs in. Here we go.
Yeah, you have your tune.
Hope you enjoy.
What was that
tune?
Oh,
it's a blues. It's a... Yeah. It's just a blues in a D.
Tempo went down after
a couple of choruses.
That's cool.
That's one of your tunes, right?
Kinda coming together.
What's it's a new one.
Yeah, it's a new one from a new I'm recording a new album now, so Boogaloo album.
Boogaloo.
You got me.
All right, here we are. Part two, Oz.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing this again.
Take two.
This is actually better. I'm sitting in New York City with Oz Noy at his apartment, and I'm having deja vu because we did this a month ago, not even a month ago. A
couple weeks ago.
But there was some audio discrepancies here and there. So it was too good.
We decided
good
to, we can do it better.
Hell yeah, man. Take. I'm not going to put out bullshit with you on it, you know. It's got to be a certain level, man.
Yeah.
You know? Let's see. Forgive me if I ask you some of the same shit.
I forgive you. You're not the first one.
But
to
I got a lot of
the
stuff I want
shit
to ask you. New stuff, too.
Yeah, let's do it.
So anyway, man. Like I said this last time, I think it's worth saying again. It's what the hell's in the water in Israel, man? Because
and
who else? There's like a bunch of badass guys.
Yeah, a lot of guys, yeah. Jazz guys especially. Actually, today, there's not only jazz guys. There's like guys that do pop and everything.
Yeah.
All I know is I haven't lived there now for like 21 years, but all I know is that there's really, really good jazz education there now.
Yeah.
When I grew up, it was okay. It was good enough, but now it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And now with the internet and our YouTube and everything, there's, you know, you can get anything you want everywhere, really.
Right.
Almost everywhere, except of North Korea, probably everywhere.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, so I don't know. I think it's good education, awareness of jazz.
Yeah.
You know, people like jazz over there.
But the, man, you know, it's just certain you guys have a feel too. You've got all the feel. You know,
we got the blues over there. That's for sure.
It's not a new thing. Yeah.
No, Israel's got the freaking blues for sure. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. Because when I grew up there, I moved out of there in 96, so I grew up there in the 80s, really, you know? So that was a whole other game. 80s, early 90s, so I don't know how I got... I still got myself the usual way, you know? People brought videos from the US, you know?
Right.
And I bought a lot of records.
Back when you had to learn stuff by ear instead of...
Yeah, I had to actually learn stuff by ear.
Instead of YouTube with a million cats, yeah.
Yeah, so that's... But I managed to somehow survive it, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a whole new generation that... There's a bunch of generations since me, actually, and they're all really, really good, you know?
You know, last time we were talking about this cat, when I was at GIT, Scott Henderson was teaching, and the first day of school, this guy plugged up and played with Scott, and I was like, what the hell, man? Who is this guy? Like, yeah, I'm in
Lior
the wrong...
Lior Yakutiel. Lior, there's a guy. Freak.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's... I knew of him because when I was growing up in the main channel, Israeli channel, there was a kid playing classical guitar on an extremely high level. Like you can find it on YouTube.
Right.
It's as good as anything. It's really kind of profound to see him. And he was like maybe 16, 15 or something. Maybe 17 or not even. And so I remember seeing him, you know, and he was, I didn't know what it is because I just started playing guitar, but that was him. And then he stopped playing classical guitar when maybe he was 18.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys that has such a unique talent. Like he's got such an extreme talent that he could do anything. And then he started to play jazz. And I remember one time I heard a song on the radio and I heard a solo that sounds like Holdsworth, and it was him playing a solo.
Wow.
That sounded like freaking Holdsworth. And then he, for a minute, he was trying to go and study in the US and stuff, but he's such an extreme talent, you know. So Scott, I talked to Scott about him many right. times because Lior is a friend of mine, you know. And Scott was like, he's probably the most talented person I've ever met. Yeah. I agree. It's really remarkable. And now he does those solo guitars on videos on YouTube. Have you
I've
seen
that? Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know? And he just sits at home in Israel somewhere and just hangs out.
I know, man. It's kind of depressing, actually. Well, let's talk about you, man. Let's talk about
but
these
enough
other
about
cats.
Me.
Yeah, but enough about me. You know, I'm glad we actually did a little rework of this episode because you gave me two of your records last time we got together, and I had a chance to check them out. Who Gives a Funk?
Yeah,
which
that's
is
the last
slamming,
studio,
man.
The last studio record I did. Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to ask you a couple things about that because I'm listening to it. I know it's going to be killer if you're playing guitar on it, but then I see, you know, Little Wing, and I'm like, usually. No, I got to be honest. When you see people do Little Wing, you're like, cool, yeah, great. Another cover of Little Wing.
Yeah.
But yours was so hip, the voicings behind it. And was that a keyboard thing that was going on behind it? Or was the guitar doing swells behind it? Or how did you...
No, I think... you're talking about what's on the track?
I'm talking about the back track. I mean, also your Hendrix-y things you were
doing. There's some looping stuff in the background. But... the other thing that's in the background is there's a 12-string guitar that's tuned different. Like, it's kind of tuned in different intervals.
Yeah.
And I play these random chords, and you put a lot of reverb on it, and it sounds like this really weird kind of textural, like, string section.
Wow.
Or it's cool, yeah. I've heard, I think, there's a record of Bill Frisell and with Elvin, and I forgot who plays bass, maybe Dave Holland, and... There's one song, maybe the first song, that he doesn't do the same thing, but he did this thing with a 12-string guitar with a lot of reverb. It's kind of the Joni Mitchell thing, really, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, wow, it's so hip, like, to put it as a pad instead of, you know? So that gave it all these kind of weird colors. And then there's a couple of reharmonizations.
Yeah, man, it's great. And then you paid, you know, homage to the...
Yeah, yeah.
That, but you did all these really
harmony, like different
crazy,
harmonics.
Like out,
yeah,
it's really hip.
Different chords. Well, you know what happened is, I used to, it's kind of funny actually, I never really played that tune much because it's kind of hard to play over it, because it's very limiting the way the chords are moving. It limits you to play a certain way. And there was a drummer that used to call me to do jazz gigs with him, or like whatever gigs. And I used to go and play with him, and we used to just call tunes. We used to play in a bar or whatever. It was in mostly in Jersey. Donnie Genta, that was his name, really good drummer. And we had a vibe, you know. So I remember once or twice we called Little Wing, and I was just really loose with it because it was a jazz gig. It wasn't like playing Little Wing in a blues bar, you know. And I started to open up. Like, I was like, okay, let me, different harmonies. That's how it started. That's how I kind of opened up. And then he sent me a recording of it, and I heard it. I was like, wow, that's got a thing, because it's all very mellow. It never goes to that real rock shit too much, and it's like very textural, you know. So that's how the whole thing started. And then actually I recorded Little Wing on Twisted Blues Volume 1, which was like a record from 5 years ago, 6 years ago, but we didn't get it right. So I re-recorded some of it. I re-recorded the drums again because it wasn't the right thing. And then I think when I re-recorded the drums, I did my guitar again, at least the solo. And then I kind of put it together in a way where it works. So to answer your question, it took me a while till I figure out a way where I can actually put it on a
record.
It's
hip, man. It's refreshing to hear.
I think a lot of people kind of missed it because it's like, you know, I think it's pretty unique way of playing the song, you know what I mean? So, so I don't know. At least I gave it a different angle, you know?
Absolutely.
When it's not like the usual thing that everybody's doing.
I mean, last time too, we talked about, you know, I'm kind of skipping around, but I think it's important to say again, but I was asking you when you came to New York, and you don't have to go into it at length, but when you came here, I didn't know if your intent was to just be solo artist, you know, the solo artist, or
my
you were doing
was
like sessions
not,
or whatever. Was
my
left.
Intent wasn't to be a solo artist. It was to do anything, really. The solo artist thing came later. Well, it never really came. Like, I never thought about it. What happened is when I moved to New York, I wanted to be noticed. So I had this trio that I was already playing in Israel that was kind of doing what I'm doing till this day, really. It was taking, like, the way it started, really, if I start from the beginning, is I used to be, in Israel, I used to always play jazz and rock. So I used to play with pop artists in Israel, rock artists in Israel, but I always used to do jazz gigs also, and I always used to do session work. So from a young age, from like the age of 15 or 16. So at a certain point, I kind of became like a Wes Montgomery clone. So I played with a thumb and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then there was a certain point where people stopped calling me for jazz gigs, and I still wanted to play. So I started my own band in Israel just to be able to get gigs to play jazz. You know, I always worked on TV and did other stuff. So I started that, and then there was a bar in Tel Aviv, in the middle of Tel Aviv, but they already had a band that plays jazz. And I wanted to play, so I went to the guy. I started to jam with a couple of friends of mine and play like Robin Ford tunes and all kind of like more electric blues, because I got into Stevie Ray Vaughan and all that stuff. So I went to the guy and I was like, hey man, what if I'm going to bring an electric band here? Would you give me a gig? And he goes like, yeah, sure. So I went there and I started to play Stevie Ray Vaughan tunes, but instrumentally. So I'll play just the grooves or the melodies.
Cool.
Actually, maybe I even played, I don't think I played Little Wing. Maybe I did, but so, and then that kind of catched, and you know, like suddenly people start to hang out. It was kind of fun. So I've done that for a couple of months, and then I got, you know, like bored with it. So I started to play R&B tunes. Like I was taking like Stevie Wonder or James Brown, and it was all instrumental. You know, it was a trio, bass, drum, guitar. So I did that for a while, and then I got bored from that. And then at the time, I wasn't doing that many, I wasn't getting called to do jazz gigs. So I was like, what happens if I'll just play all my jazz stuff, all my Wes Montgomery thing or whatever, just on those grooves? And that's what I did. And that's really been the concept of my band till today, really, you know, in a way, you know. So when I moved to New York, I already had this thing going in Israel, and one of my friends that played with me there was here. So I called him. I was like, hey, man, can we do a tape? It was like a tape cassette
to
get a gig at the bitter end, you know? That.
Yeah.
And I thought that by playing a solo gig when, you know, it's my band, I'll get gigs.
Right.
Little did I know that when you do a solo gig and you get your name out as a solo artist, nobody calls you for gigs, you know, because they think about you as a solo artist. But at the time, I just wanted to be noticed, you know?
Yeah.
So I did this trio with a couple of friends, and that's how I started to play the bitter end. So I was playing the bitter end once a month, really just to play, you know? And then I record, they had this, they still have it, they have two mics in a room that are really nice sounding mics, and at the time they used to record to a tape. So I had a bunch of tapes and I put a couple of tunes on a CD, you know?
Yeah.
Burn it onto a CD. There's a really great guitar player in New York named Mark Schulman. He's a really, really great, unique player, does studio work, play a lot of guys. He somehow heard the tape and he started to come to my gigs, and he was the first guy that kind of made me think that maybe I have something going on. And at some point he goes like, you got to do a record with this thing. And I've done demos of other stuff and I just tried to get pop gigs or record or really actually get any work I could, you know?
Yeah.
So then he told me that and he was kind of pushing me to do it. And then I went to Israel one time for a visit. And I have friends of mine that has a really nice studio there, the producers. So I used to always bring them the latest thing I did. Like I used to play with Gavin DeGraw and people like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, check this stuff. It was demos for Gavin before he got famous and all that stuff. So then I brought that stuff to them and some other chick singer or whatever, or other demos that I've done. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's cool. And then I went like, hey, listen to this. And they listened to it and they flipped out. It goes like, man, this has got such a vibe. You should make a record out of this.
Wow.
So after that, I kind of went like, I was touring with Richard Bona for a year. That was in 2000. I was in Richard's band and I quit the band. It was a kind of a rough touring situation with him. It was great. It was funny as hell. But so when I quit it, I kind of was back in New York kind of with nothing, you know? So I thought about it. I was like, yeah, what the hell? Let me do this. So I called a friend of mine that had a D88. And he brought a DADA to the bitter end, like 8 tracks. And we recorded 4 shows. It was like two Sundays, 2 sets, you know? What we did is we recorded a sound check and a gig.
Ah,
I think that's
okay.
What it was. So I had 4 takes, 4 shows. And then I edited on, that was when I got Pro Tools. I kind of edited a little bit. And that was the first record that was live, you know? And after that, I got a record deal from a small company, Magna Carta.
Yeah, you're
but, sure. You know, as small as they were, they gave me a budget to make real records. Like I've done, they gave me budget to make like, what is that? I did like 4 records for them.
Wow. It's like now it's like, what's a budget?
$10,000 a record? Good luck with that. I never thought about being a solo artist. And even when I was doing those records and I started to get articles and guitar magazines and stuff, I never really thought about it. I just wanted to work in New York and play. I didn't care if it was me. Even till this day, I don't want to only play my own music.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play with other people too. I like it.
Nah, you don't really want to do that.
I do. To a certain degree,
the grass
is
always greener, man.
No, but you know, but I always like to do a couple different things. So that's what happened. The rest of his is history.
Yeah, I remember first hearing about you, and I was like, man, this cat's doing his own thing in New York. It's not an easy thing to do.
No.
And,
9 records later.
Wow, 9. Yeah. Well, you're going on 10 then.
Well, the Ozone Squeeze, the new record with that new band that I have, that's actually the 10th. I think it's a 10th or 9. I can't remember. But I'm recording now. The record I'm recording now is either the 9th or the 10th.
Now, last time I was asking you about the Sissy Strut, for instance. Yeah. You showed me a chart and everything. Yeah, I'm always really interested in how cats in a logistically challenging place like Manhattan is to rehearse and get together, and how guys pull it off and make it sound like, you know, I've done a little bit of it and it's not easy, but you have like multiple rhythm sections, horn players.
Well, here's the thing. The thing is, it's a little deceiving because if you look at the first three records, like I've been a solo artist since 2001, yeah? Mm-hmm. Like 2002, that's when the live record came out. So like 15 years now or something. The first couple of years, I would say up to even maybe 2012 or something, it was pretty much mostly the same guys. It's like Keith Carlock and Anton Fick play drums. There's another drummer called Rocky Bryan that I use a lot here. He played on the last album. And then bass players, it's always been James Genus or Wee Lee. It's pretty much it. When I tour, I have to tour with other people too, you know what I mean? So, because it's impossible to only use these guys. Over the years, it's expanded mostly because, you know, I wanted to also play with other people. But, you know, I started to work with Dave Weckl a lot. So Dave kind of joined the situation. And then Will doesn't tour. He had the TV show. Genus is busy sometimes. So then, you know, we did something. We did a tour with Daryl Jones. We did some tours with Jimmy Haslip. So I kind of get these other guys to kind of join the party. But it's because you get those tours and you have to work. But the core of people that I've been working with till the Twisted Blues Volume 1, Volume 2, those records, it's been the same people. Will Lee played on my records till today. He's playing on the new one, you know? Right. So it's the same guys. Carlock doesn't live in New York anymore. Anton's been playing with me, but now the Letterman show is over, he's been touring with Bonamassa. So things have changed, that's true, and I'm going to different directions too. But the first couple of records is the same guys.
Yeah. Well, just rehearsing and everything.
Rehearsing is, I got lucky because I always had a room. Somebody had a room. Like Anton had a room that you can go into. I had a situation here and there. There was always something that you can kind of get into. But I'll tell you, rehearsals were very, very short.
Yeah.
The way I do it is I write the tune. I make demos here that are very, very kind of sparse. You know, it's just like a drum beat.
Yeah.
That's usually the drum beat that I want. And then I usually come up with a bass part and I write those. Then I play the melody. and then I bring it to the guys and that's it. We do a short rehearsal and the rest is rehearsing live. Yeah. Like literally we play live. I never record before I play live a bunch. So
that's smart.
Yeah, so that's how it comes together. It doesn't come together in rehearsal. It comes together playing live, you know? So that's kind of how I've been doing it. It's gotten more challenging now because Manhattan's changed. So
yeah, man, it's not
harder
easy.
And harder,
yeah.
You know.
Just lugging my little bullshit rig to Iridium last night was lucky I could leave it there. Yeah. But I think it's funny to go to 55 Bar and go in, you know, Mike's got his like that ancient Yamaha amp back there and Wayne Krantz has got his Martin. They just leave it there.
Yeah, they
it's
leave it.
Funny to watch.
I know. But it sounds great. You
yeah,
hear that,
oh yeah,
you know,
it
that's
sounds
the
great.
Thing. Yeah, it's New York.
Yeah. Watching when we were playing your tune just now, your right hand, who did you listen to get your that kind of straight
I don't know, I didn't
you didn't
I don't
really
think
listen
about
to anybody
it.
No.
I never you know, I grew up in the 80s, so I there was a lot of shredding going on.
Yeah,
so
did you ever get into that? Like, learn some stuff?
Of course.
Like Steve Vai stuff?
Yeah, well, I never got in. I can't play the Steve Vai stuff. But I had, like, Paul Gilbert and Greg Howe and Richie Kotzen, like, videos.
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure. I was into it heavily. Yeah. But then I was also into bebop.
Uh-huh.
It was a very
sounds familiar
time in my life.
Yeah. It was great, man. That was really, just think about it. It was awesome. That
some
was before the
real good
the
guitar playing, yeah. Yeah. Some real good, like, whether you like the music or not, it's a pretty it virtuosic, you know, yeah. Satriani, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I grew up on, you know. It was tough when grunge came in and destroyed that whole thing.
One of my favorite interviews ever is Dweezil Zappa interviewing Eddie Van Halen.
Oh,
I told him, Dweezil was on my podcast, and I told him this on the podcast. I said, Dweezil, you remember that interview you did with Eddie Van Halen? He goes, yeah. I said, man, I loved it because I read it, and it was every question I ever want to ask Eddie. Like, how many takes did it take you to do Eruption?
Yeah.
You know, and Dweezil's like, knows him since he's a kid.
Yeah,
you
of
know?
Course. Yeah.
But my favorite thing was, Eddie, aren't you sick of Nirvana and these grunge bands that, you know, the solos, you know, and blah, 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 and shitty guitar playing?
Yeah.
And Eddie goes, you know what? And it's a good answer. I agree, actually. Eddie goes, you know what? I think it, even if someone is expressing themselves on one string, even if it's not technically great, it's still expression and it still merits being music, which is cool. Yeah. But then Dweezil says, yeah, but I'm sick of solos that suck.
That's that true also.
I have another thing I want to bring up to anybody that's an engineer, recording engineer. Like, when did we start tracking and stop recording? You know what I mean? That's sort of not a pet peeve, but it's like everything is tracking.
Yeah,
guitar. I'm
tracking.
It's
why
don't you just say recording?
Yeah.
I thought tracking is when you like do the actual rhythm tracks.
Yeah, interesting.
And then everything else post is recording.
Maybe because of Pro Tools or something? Like,
I don't know, but everything is tracking now. You see on Instagram. Tracking today.
Like,
what are you tracking? Like a bear in the woods? Or
maybe you're tracking a bear in the woods.
I don't know. Somebody out there is like, what an asshole. Why does he say that?
Yeah.
That one, and he passed. He passed. He died. You know, people say
passed.
It's
why is
it passed?
Well, he passed to the next...
He passed what? It's a transitive verb. Like, he passed what? You mean he passed away.
Yeah.
He passed.
Yeah. Or, well, I'm my English second language.
No, man. Or, here's another one. You ever go to a restaurant with somebody, it's like, you guys decide what you want? Yeah, I'm going to do the chicken salad.
Yeah.
And I'll do the... It's like, I couldn't do it.
What are you going to do?
Why don't you just order it?
Yeah. That's funny.
That's my little
you know,
Seinfeld
Will's got
rant.
Will's got a bunch of those. Talk Does to he? Him. Are you going to interview Will?
Yeah, he's already been on here.
Oh, he's already done it?
Yeah, he's like 15 episodes ago. He loves the riffraff. He listens to all. He'll listen to this one. Yeah.
Nice.
I'll ask him about it because I'm going to see him coming up. That's my little nothing to do with guitar playing rant.
Yeah. Seinfeld.
Some of your funk influences, because you got some funky chops, man. You know,
I just listen to records, you know, like James Brown, of course, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Oh, yeah, Al McKay.
Yeah, I love that stuff. You know, a lot of the Prince stuff, all the stuff that has really cool guitar parts, you know, like the early, all the Quincy Jones stuff got great stuff, like Michael Jackson, like the old stuff. It's great rhythm guitar. Yeah. Some Chaka Khan's got good rhythm guitar. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of stuff, but you know, between Prince and James Brown and Earth, Wind and Fire.
Well, that's a lot right there.
Yeah, I can't. I'm trying to think who else, but Stevie Wonder. A lot of Stevie Wonder. Oh yeah. Stevie Wonder doesn't have much guitar, but his whole thing is just so.
Dean Parks played on some of that original
true.
Stuff.
True, and a couple. Yeah, but it's not much. It's not guitar.
Michael Cimbello.
Cimbello, yeah.
That guy was a really good player.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, he played some good solos too.
He was a maniac.
Yeah, is
it? That was that tune, but that great
oh,
guitar.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're
that
right with the guitar solo. The great
guitar
solo.
That was him that played that. He studied with Pat Martino, actually.
Really?
Yeah, he's a Philly guy, I think. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, Stevie Wonder, that kind of stuff always influenced me. Till now, I like this, of course. It's,
yeah.
You know? Yeah. I'm trying to think what else, but I can't think of anything. You know, the meters and all that stuff. Meters and... That came later when I moved here. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I wasn't aware of. That I moved here and I suddenly got turned on to, you know?
Right.
Some of the Herbie stuff with the Headhunters.
Oh, I love
course.
That stuff,
yeah.
Man. Actual Proof. And
yeah,
all
Actual
that.
Proof, that stuff, you know. But a lot of it I got turned on to here more than when I was in, before I moved to New York, you know?
Yeah, I kind of started listening to stuff and way later, man. Like
I only found out about stuff when I moved to New York.
Yeah, like Cornell Dupree.
Yeah, Cornell and Eric Gales and, you know, and Gordon Edwards and, yeah.
It's funny, like I listen to Cornell Dupree and yeah, he'll play licks and it's kind of out of tune, but it sounds great, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's always like kind of sharp.
You know, there was a time when I moved to New York, I started to play with a bass player. He's the guy that discovered me in New York, this guy named Frank Canino. He's a good bass player. He used to play with Cornell and all those stuff guys. Yeah. So he turned me on to it. And then there was a short period of a year when Cornell lived in New York, kind of moved back to New York with his wife, and he was doing gigs here all the time. So I used to sometimes sit in with him, and it was just when I moved to New York, so maybe the second year or something, or third year. So I was just getting hip to him, you know? And that was pretty cool because I didn't know that thing exists at all. And he was one of those guys that always sounded the same. Like, you know, he sounded exactly like the records.
Plug into a whatever
it doesn't
shitty
matter.
Backline
it sounded
Fender
exactly
twin.
Like the
yeah,
record. It didn't. Good. He didn't lose anything. It was just that thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for a year, I used to see him play all the time, like a lot. There was a lot of things going on with him, and then he moved to Jersey, and then at some point he moved back to Texas and then to Jersey. I can't remember, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an Aretha Franklin live at the Fillmore West.
Yeah.
That's a great record.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Cornell. Maybe it's Eric Gale, but it's Jerry Jamont, like Bernard Purdy. Who I saw Purdy play with you at Bitter End one with Will.
Oh, the
at your Boogaloo.
We did like a tour in Asia, in Japan, and we played the Iridium.
You got any good Bernard Purdy stories?
I got a lot.
That you
but
can
I
share?
Can't, but I can't
something
share
that's
them.
Sort of G-rated, maybe. I'm looking at your pedal board there with all these cool goodies on it. But if you, I'll just ask you a trick question. If you had to go to a gig and you could only take one, like let's say you could only take three pedals. I'm curious because I want to know this. Like what would you take?
I'll take a Tube Screamer
mm-hmm.
or an exotic, some sort of like the... Like I have my pedal.
Right,
now,
you
so,
have your
yeah, but those are two pedals at once, so it doesn't.
Well, it's still
one. RC and AC.
Still one power.
I will take
jack.
One. I will take that because it's very versatile. Either that or a Tube Screamer 808. I'll take a tremolo of some sort, or a Y. Depends on the gig, and I'll take a delay. That's it. Four slap.
Okay, well that's four, but
three. So get rid of one.
That's the problem, man.
Yeah.
You know,
like, I've done. I was in Japan, China. I was in tour in Asia. I was in China, and one gig they didn't have a transformer for my pedal board, and it was with my trio with Wacko and Haslip, and you know, I had to do my pyrotechnics, and I couldn't do it. So I have this Vamoran made me this fuzz. It's got my name on it. It's like mm-hmm. my signature fuzz, and it's a great pedal. And I had that with a battery and a wah. And that's all I could use. I did my whole gig with a fuzz and a wah.
Wow.
And it was awesome.
I'll
so
bet.
To answer your question, if I really had the balls, I would just bring a wah and that fuzz, and I'll be it.
Life's
and a
simple.
Delay, and I'll be fine. I'll be just fine.
And maybe a delay.
No, but I did the whole gig with a wah and a fuzz.
I believe it, man.
It was great.
And it just depends, you know. You see guys just like, well, I just believe in plugging straight into the amp. It's like, yeah, great. But if you're backing up, so-and-so and you need sound.
I think if you have a good fuzz pedal, you can do a lot with a fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of different colors that you can't really do with an overdrive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of colors. I have one of those Dallas Arbiter, you know, the ones that Eric uses, Eric Johnson uses. I have one of the prototypes that I made for him. I somehow got a hold of one. And if you just plug it in your rig, it's very problematic because it's boomy and it's bassy and it's like, it sounds great. It's that real sound. But it's almost like if you use that pedal, you have to tune the amp to the pedal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But once you do that, it's freaking awesome. Like, you can just use that pedal and you can do a lot of stuff with it.
Listen to Lanois, man. He plugs his gold top into whatever, that old fuzz, K fuzz.
Yeah,
whatever.
There you go.
Sounds great.
Yeah, man. The fuzzes are kind of magical. It's just,
I should get a fuzz. I have...
You just have to find
the
right one.
Actually, I only have an Octafuzz. That's the only fuzz pedal I have.
Fuzzes are very tricky to find, like something good that works. There's a lot of things out there, but... it's tricky.
Guitar is almost becoming, you know, it's...
There's no guitar on the radio now at all.
My greatest fear is that the guitar is going to be like the saxophone solo, and you know, on pop records, like everything had saxophone solos, and now I think it's like, wow, you're going to put a guitar solo on it? It's so cheesy, you know?
Well, that will go away too, though. It all comes in cycles, you know?
Well, man, let's play something else. I don't know. Shit.
You want to play like a minor blues?
Sure. Shit.
Beautiful shit play, it is, man.
It's not shit. So what is that guitar? That's a, is that a reissue Tele?
It's
that
just a custom shop Tele. It's a 58 Tele.
Oh, it looks cool. Really?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's got the stock pickup things?
Yeah, I never touched anything. I just changed the frets, that's all.
Well, I guess we should talk a little bit about pedals, because I know all the guitar players that are going to listen is like, you're sitting with Oz.
What do you need to know?
I don't know. I mean, you've already probably answered this in other interviews, but I actually have a question pertaining to your the Ozone Squeeze record.
Oh, yes.
The tune called Skylark.
Yes.
The solo.
Yes.
Is that an octafuzz?
Yes. That's my little trick. I've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
It's an octafuzz. When you use an octafuzz, you turn the you use the bridge pickup and you turn the volume down. I can do. I'm not plugged in. Shit. But when you take bridge pickup and you turn the volume down, you get that really expressive kind of almost sitar sound. You know. So that's what it is.
A shitar.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much.
A shitar.
A shitar, yeah.
It sounds cool, man. So are you using, because I have one of those pedals and I use it a lot. Are you using the fuzz side or the octave?
No, always the octave. The one that I have is a Dunlop Octavia. It's like that Hendrix one.
Oh, okay.
It's great. So yeah. That's what I use.
Yeah, it's a cool sound.
Yeah, it's great. You can do a lot of stuff. I use it for a lot of things because you get all this, just by using the volume knob on the guitar, you get all these really quirky sounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. I've been doing it for years.
You know, like the tune we played, the Boogaloo tune, yeah. I like your tunes the way they like at the end of a section, you'll go up or you'll do some chord like out of nowhere, you know? And I think that tune had that too. But and then Dweezil came in with that crazy Indian shit.
Yeah,
crazy shit.
Pretty good. Yeah. You're right. That's
great, man. Tune I Got You.
Oh yeah,
the solo, man. What do you like? There's a really fast passage. It sounds like you're cycling something. Like
I have no idea. It's like a the James Brown tune, you know. I feel
well.
Good.
Yeah, but what you play is not anything like
that. Well, you know, I play it instrumental and I play it faster.
No, but the solo part.
Over a blues, so I'm playing whatever I play over blues, like all my intricate jazz stuff. I don't know what I've done at the time, at the moment when I played on it.
Yeah.
It's funny, like, you get, sometimes I get, like, transcriptions of people transcribing my solos, you know? Or people are playing, like, I see people, somebody's playing my solo, and I look at, sometimes I look at her and go, like, oh, it's not so bad. It actually sounds good. When somebody else plays it, you go, like, oh, it's not bad. And sometimes, like, I was like, I don't have an idea how I did this. Like, I don't know. I probably, if I'll figure it out, I'll know what it is. But I was like, how the hell did I, you know?
Right.
You know?
Well, that means it's coming from... you know, hopefully a place that's
it works fresh out, you know.
I mean, you ever do that? You ever, like, not listen to your records for a long time and then listen to it and either think, man, it's really shitty, or wow, this is pretty good?
Yeah, but it's usually the opposite. Usually it's like, pretty mediocre.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But you know, I gotta be honest, there's, on each record I've done, there's like one or two songs that I think are really good. You know? And then there's maybe one or two solos on each record that I think are pretty good. And then the rest of it's like, yeah. Plus the other thing is, you know, I make records, all the records I've done till now, they're all low budget. So I can't spend a lot of time in the studio and fuss around with my tone and with this and with that. Which is, it could be a good thing, but it's the same thing with mixing. I can't sit and mix a record for a week, you know? So a lot of things that I kind of... you kind of have to let go, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. But when I listened to it, I was like, oh, I wish I could remix the whole thing. Or I wish I could play this song. I wish I could, you know what I mean? But what are you going to do? It's like, if I had a lot more money, I would.
You'd
do.
Be like Eric Johnson.
Yeah. Just release a record every 8 years.
Yeah. Obsess he's got, over it.
Exactly, yeah. I'm not into that. But that's what comes up, like, a lot of times I listen to. It's rare that I listen to something, I go, like, the tone is good, the mix is good, and I play good. And the tune is good.
Wow. Well, that's high standards for yourself, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the same way.
Yeah. I just don't want to hear like it. That.
You know.
If other people enjoy it, then that's what's important.
Yeah. You know? Exactly. I thought it was cool that you had Alan Toussaint on one of your records. And
on
you were
two
saying,
of them. Two of them. Well, you know, he I did Twisted Blues Volume 1, and... I needed a piano solo on something. And Will says, like, yeah, call Alan. And I was like, sure. And I knew his name. I've seen him all around. But I didn't really know who he was.
Yeah.
Like, I just knew he was the New Orleans guy. And da, da, da. And I thought he would really fit the tune.
Yeah.
So I called him and he came and he played. And you know Alan?
Sure, I knew
him.
He was
such a beautiful guy. Yeah. So he was like, and so, you know, so he came and we hang out. It was great. And he came and see me play a couple times before. But then after he played on the first record, he played a great solo on this rumba. And then he used to, every time he was in New York, I was like, yeah, come play with us. And he used to come and play with us a lot. There's actually a really great video on YouTube when we play in CC Strut, and the guy took the shot from the video, is his face from his angle. So you see his face and you see all of us in the background. It's really great.
Wow, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, so, you know, but I never knew how... heavy was, like, I used to call him and ask him, hey, man. You know, I never really realized how heavy the guy is. And then he played on the second record also, but he was really cool. He really liked what I was doing, you know, so he was just down for it. Yeah. You know, on the Twisted Blues Volume 2, I had a slow blues and I knew already that I want him to play over, and he just came over and played. He was great.
Yeah, he's a great guy, great songwriter.
He actually gave me the best compliment I ever got ever in my life.
What was that?
The first time he came to record, like I said, I usually don't do overdubs, but sometimes if you have to, you know, especially if it's a steady groove and you don't have to do too much interaction. So I had to put this piano solo on this rumba on the Twisted Blues Volume 1 record. So I sent him the track, and it already had my solo on it, you know? So he came to the studio, he played great, and then at the end of the session, he goes, hey, you got a CD player, I want to play something. So we played the CD player, and he transcribed my solo on the piano note for note, and he played the whole solo. He recorded himself playing the whole solo. Yeah, I have it somewhere. Wow. He did it, yeah,
that's,
I know,
cool.
It was amazing.
It must have taken a lot of time to do that, too.
And he loved it. He goes, like, oh, man, it's great stuff in there. I was like, wow.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, Alan liked really good players, man. He let people do their thing. You know, I didn't get to work with him a lot, but I did do some recording and a couple.
You know, I have this version of CC Strut when I move the beat, like the line a little bit. It's still in 4/4, but I move the phrase. And I'm sure that some of the Meters guys wouldn't be so excited about it. But, you know, he produced that track, that whole record. Right. And he played that with me, that video, is doing my version. And I remember when we were at the Bitter End, I was like, is this cool? He goes like, oh, yeah, it's totally cool. He loved, like, new stuff, you know? So I got approval from the producer.
You got approval. Well, I remember playing Sissy Strut with Art Neville many, many times. And every time we would go to, you know...
Yeah,
I would do the you remember Schofield's version?
Yes,
where it would modulate to A flat.
Yeah.
You know, so I would do it, and they stayed in C. So I would go instead of. I would go.
Oh, you go. Oh, and he'd
look back like what?
Yeah.
But I kept playing it anyway because you know, Sco's thing was pretty hip.
Yeah.
I always like go to the A flat, but
yeah.
You know, that thing's become like Mustang Sally or something.
It is.
But I like the way you did it. What's the concept behind Twisted Blues, that whole concept behind those records?
Okay, so in the beginning, there was no concept. I was just writing tunes that kind of turn into be more bluesy, you know? But, you know, I wrote something with a Holton scale, turned out to be Holton blues. Then I wrote all these rumbas that had more advanced chords. So then when I was done with my schizophrenic record, I had those tunes, and I thought... Wow, this is kind of more in a bluesier kind of way. So let me take all these blues forms and try to kind of expand them harmonically and rhythmically too. So that's how, that was the idea behind the Twisted Blues records. So I think I did pretty good because I had like a 6-4 blues there and like some weird, like I was able to find some weird forms that were kind of cool. Like they're not the usual stuff. It's still some blues, but it's not the usual stuff. Which kind of got me thinking recently about, you know, like kind of the state of the blues today. I thought about it where, you know, like in jazz developed all like jazz, like it started as Dixie music, then it turned into bebop, then it turned into hard bop, then it turned into a lot of other things that are all today and they're all great. But every time when I'm thinking about blues, it hasn't really gone anywhere. It's almost like if it was equal to jazz, it's almost like it stayed in bebop. Like everybody's really precious about sounding like B.B. King or Buddy Guy, which is great. Those guys are the innovator. But it's been kind of like, why does people not expanding that a little more? Because everything I hear, like... Really, Stevie Ray Vaughan was the last guy that had his own sound and voice. Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Johnson. The only other guy I can think of these days that have his own voice that expanded the blues is Derek Trucks.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really think about anybody else. It's almost like everybody else that's playing blues just tried to copy what was done. And what was done is great. And what's done today is like some of those guys copied great, but... I don't understand why people don't...
Well, yeah, there tend to be a lot of purists. That
exactly. There's like way too much purism in blues today. If you would have... if you were kind of take that and compare it to jazz, it would mean that bebop would have been still the main form of jazz today.
Right.
Which is kind of ridiculous. Jazz has been gone so far. Even like, you know, thinking about Wes Montgomery, that was a... revolutionizing jazz guitar. You know, since then, Pep Metheny, Schofield, Frizzell, Mike Stern came. Since then, like Kurt Rosenwinkel,
right.
I don't know, Mike Moreno, Neer Felder, Gilad Axelman, there's like tons of guys, and it's all different stuff, and it's all great. I don't understand why in the blues world people don't kind of push the envelope. And I'm not talking about playing out of the, like, jazz harmonies, like what I did. I just took blues forms and I put jazz harmony on them and play my jazz stuff. I'm just talking about coming up with your own voice within the style.
I think maybe, yeah, you're right. I'm trying to, my brain's
I've been thinking
like
about
going
it a
through.
Lot.
Maybe
recently.
Larry Carlton might have done some.
Larry, and Robin Ford.
Especially
and Larry.
In the 80s, Larry was doing, you know, back.
Yeah, Larry and Robin.
And really. Robin, that talked to your daughter, that was kind of.
Yeah, true.
That was sort of a commercial thing, too.
Yeah. But everything I hear blues, like, I don't hear anything new that's.
I don't really know much about it. I'm not qualified to really.
Like, blues can be also, like, R&B-ish.
Because I don't really listen. I don't listen to a lot of blues. But
it's really interesting that part never got kind of really. It's not that it hasn't been developed.
Right.
Like, you know, like, Joe Bonamassa is an amazing player.
Right.
But there's nothing new. You know, he just does what he does really, really well.
But I think that's what appeals, that's what brings people to blues, is the familiarity and the simplicity. You know, you don't have to have
possible.
It's easy listening almost for the ear. You know where a chord, even if you don't have any sort of training in music, you know the chord's going to go to a four chord.
Yeah.
Even though you don't know that you know it.
Yeah. Maybe that's it.
It just sounds familiar. I mean.
Nobody takes chances. Let's put it like that in the
blues.
It's like it's very pure. There's a lot of purism, and it's always,
what do they call
those sounds?
The blues Nazis,
you know? Yeah, you can call it the blues Nazis.
That's what
it's kind of like, the bebop Nazis is the same thing. But in jazz they were able to get away from, to break out of that. In blues it's still as strong as ever, you know, which I found really interesting. You know, I'm not like a blues player, but I like that stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyhow, it's just a point that I been thinking about recently. Yeah, do a blues.
A little short, little jam. Thank you. Thanks, man.
Yeah,
sounded
of course. Thank
beautiful.
You too.
Second time's a charm, they say. So I'm have faith this is going to come out this time. So, all right, man.
Cool.
Now show me that Les Paul.
All right, if you're still listening, thanks a lot. Yeah, Oz was selling a Les Paul that was beautiful. Yeah, I really thought about that one, but I need another guitar like a hole in the head. But if you're looking for a Les Paul, maybe he still has it. It's beautiful. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. As always, love your comments, ratings, all that stuff. Tune in next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.